But you get some interesting, and then you get close to some of the judges that you, either in adjoining courtroom or in, well, somebody who was adjoining my courtroom in 13th Street was on my floor, although not an adjoining courtroom out there. We used to get together occasionally. And he once raised the question, he said, "What do you do about all those phone calls?" I looked at him, I said, "What do you mean?" "Well, you know, somebody calls and says they're a friend of the defendant, some political figure. And how do you, what, first place, how do you handle the call? And then how, what do you tell the guy? And then secondly, what do you do about it?" And I said, "Well, I've never met that problem." And I apparently had a fearsome reputation that somehow I was different from other judges, and that you were not to call me, that it would not, and it, you know, it made life a lot easier, and another case I had was a wife beating, and it was in the black community, and you know, the wife had gone to some social service agency, and they had the forethought to take pictures, and you know, had put on a pretty strong case, and the defense wasn't much. I found him guilty of, I forget what, battery, like aggravated battery, probably something like that, and sentenced him to. And then one of the black judges came up to me and said, "What on earth were you thinking of? That's her husband." As if that's no offense. If it's beating up on a woman is an offense unless it's your wife. And I said, "Well, the evidence was pretty strong." Then he said to me, "You know that he was a friend of Tim Evans, don't you?" Now, Tim Evans was the committeeman by then of my taking over from Claude Holman. And I said, "Well, no, I did not know that. And it's to Tim's everlasting credit that I did not know." So, you know, you stumble onto rather startling things that way. Had one case where I probably had the highest price legal staff assembled for the defense. There were four defendants who were accused of nothing more seriously than stealing from the liquor store, big chain of them, I forget, but they had one in Hyde Park, I remember. Lake Park. Anyway, they were noticing losses from stock, and so they hired a Pinkerton guy to come in as assistant store manager, unbeknownst to anybody. And so he sort of found out what was going on. I guess they invited him in. You know, fortunately, he wasn't a police officer, so it wasn't entrapment, but I think he went along with the program to find out what was doing. And, you know, these guys, none of them had a record, and this was a felony charge, and none of them wanted a felony record. The state's attorney was perfectly happy to plead them to probation. I made clear that the sentence wouldn't matter, you know, if they, whether they took a trial or not. I mean, they were clearly eligible for probation, but if they wanted a trial, they could have it. They were trying to get it knocked down somehow to a misdemeanor or get an acquittal. And between the four of them, they had three private attorneys who were, you know, pretty well known in the field. And they lost the case. I mean, there wasn't much of an issue. Tully called me and said, the owners of the liquor store called him and said, do you know Swain? Tully told him, just relax, he's going to do what's right, but you don't need to worry about anybody getting to him. Mm-hmm. That was what he was afraid of, that somebody would, too much pressure, but, you know, it didn't even start, so I didn't really have to do anything about it. And, you know, I have a feeling it goes back to my first Christmas at the state's attorney's office when I sent back all the Christmas presents. Did I cover that last?
No, you didn't.
I was aware that from just practicing that at Christmas time, a number of the public offices were full of gift wrap liquor bottles, for example, and they would be on the attorney's desks in the state's attorney's office and one thing or another. So I thought to myself, now I better be prepared for this. How am I going to handle this? And here again, you're in for a lot of surprises. My initial thought was I would just say, oh, thank you very much, but I don't accept gifts, but thank you anyway. I appreciate your kind thought. And I was startled at the fury that this invoked or caused. And it wasn't all just liquor. People would hand me envelopes, and people would mail me cheeses at home, send around fruit baskets and things. And you know, I was in a fairly pivotal position in the state's attorney's office, you know, people would say, you know, really get hot under the collar. Are you calling me a crook? So I finally had realized I really had to change my approach and say, you know, I really appreciate the thought behind this, and it's very generous of you, and it certainly is no reflection on you, but I, as just a personal idiosyncrasy, I decided not to accept gifts. And they just shake their heads as if I were crazy and let it go with that. I once got a big basket of something from Stop and Shop, which was then on Washington. And so yeah, the next morning after it came, I brought it down to Stop and Shop and said, I want to return this. And would you credit the account of whoever, the guy that sent it? And I, of course, had a card with it. They said, well, is it something you didn't like? Would you like something else in its place? I said, no, I'm sorry, I'm not in a position to accept it. They said, well, why aren't you in a position to accept it? And I said, well, I work for the county. And they said, I don't understand. I said, well, just credit them for it. Don't try to understand. And sometimes I would get perishables at home, like somebody sent a case of oranges or something, and I'd take it to one of the settlement houses. Mm-hmm. I couldn't send it back at that point. It would rot or something. And I would let them send a thank you note to the guy. You know, even that's getting pretty close to the line, because, you know, I was looking like the benefactor. Mm-hmm. But I wanted them to be clear that they made clear to the person who sent it I couldn't accept it, but that they are very appreciative of having it. And that they, I insisted they add that person to their mailing list so that he would get done in the future. I mean, integrity takes all sorts of forms. You know? You understand about integrity? You've never had any problems with it.
Not really.
But anyway, I think that, I think this, that story, I certainly didn't expect, I expected that to be just a private matter between me and each of the people who came in.
But apparently the story got around.
Yeah, and I think that's why it stuck with me all of, and that's why mm-hmm. they didn't come near me here as a judge.
Yeah.
And, but there was one unhappy group that I felt sort of bad about. And that was the clerks and secretaries that worked mm-hmm. for me, who used to get the overflow.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, you're giving away our material. I said, well, I realize that. I don't mind if you take things, but I can't.
Mm-hmm.
of course, nobody would offer it to them. I guess one or two did, but. So, I had only one case where I was not sure I lost any sleep over. Again, it was a very high-priced attorney. And he put on this defense alibi. And he had a parade of witnesses like nobody's business, and all very credible, and everybody testifying that on this particular night he had been at the party. I don't know what sort of party it was. And the cross-examination always consisted of, well, when the defendant told you he'd been charged with an offense that evening, your first thought was, oh, we must tell his attorney. No. When did you tell his attorney? Well, we didn't until he came to us. And it was pretty clear they'd manufactured the whole alibi thing. The whole story was true. I mean, you can tell by the detail that it happened, but it just, there's nothing to tie it into the night that he committed the offense. So I found him guilty, and the state had a pretty persuasive case, but I often wondered if the defense had taken a different tack. And I guess the thing that haunted me, you know, my defendants never expressed anger at the court. And this kid seemed to be more concerned about what I thought of him. And as he was leaving the courtroom after being sentenced, he looked up at me and said, "Judge, I didn't do it." And I nodded to him. I mean, he wasn't complaining. I mean, there's a wide cynicism in the black community that the system doesn't work anyway. And that was haunting. I can't tell you how many times I reviewed the evidence in that case and cursed the attorney for taking the tack he did, because, you know, the alibi was just not, I mean, it was demonstrably an afterthought. I had another one where a very similar alibi offense occurred on December 31st, 2 o'clock in the morning. He had two very good defense attorneys, hired, you know, paid, not public defender, and they put on this case. Again, they brought in the stream of witnesses, and this was a New Year's Eve party, so there wasn't any question about when it was. And when it got to the closing arguments, something that I had noticed back at the beginning, and the state's attorney was sitting there just on pins and needles for fear I would blow it, that 2 a.m. on December 31st is not New Year's Eve. New Year's morning. I mean, it's the morning of the day that becomes New Year's Eve. It was 24 hours off. They finally filed a motion for a new trial on the grounds of incompetence of counsel. I mean, they filed it themselves. And as one of the prosecutors said, this is a good object lesson. And if you have a witness who will say anything for the defendant, be sure you get your facts right. right, before you come in with your story. They had some of the most persuasive witnesses. They were lined up. And the role of the judge was one of the things that's sort of hard to get used to. That is, you can't do the other people's job. If the state's attorney blows it, like, that's you know, I mean, you can't sort of realize that they're incompetent and skew your ruling on the basis of that. And the same way with the defense, and that's a harder one. If the defense doesn't have a good attorney, you worry about. But, you know, you're protected by clear and convincing, I mean, beyond a reasonable doubt, burden of proof. So you have to be darn sure. And the problem is that if you try to do somebody else's job, not only do you not do their job well, you don't do your job well. And you can be manipulated that way too. So. Anything particular you want to know beyond this? What I did after, in my afterlife?
Well, I actually had a quick question about your time on the bench. How often did you have a bench trial compared to a jury trial?
Oh, yeah, about 3 or 4 to 1. Very, very small percentage were jury trials. Most of them were bench trials. Just in the, I mean, I don't think the attorneys want. I think the attorneys, first place, they get acquainted with the judges and know whether they're going to get a fair shake. And second, they don't want to waste their time if it's not going to benefit them. So you get a murder case where you think long and hard about what you want there, anything that will give your guy even a slight possibility of doing better, you're going to grab onto. No, I had one, and now that's the cases that go to trial. And that's no more than 25%. 75% are pleaded out. And, you know, I see all these erudite articles about how bad plea bargaining is. And I just shake my head in disbelief. They don't have any idea what they're talking about. But they think this is somebody's getting away with something, and that, you know, it's a con game. And, you know, it's... it makes the system run a lot more smoothly. If everybody went to trial, the system would break down, for one thing.
Just from the sheer volume?
Yeah, can't handle that many trials. And you put at a plea bargaining conference, they lay out the evidence they're gonna present. And it didn't occur to me first that the attorneys were looking for guidance, and I would listen to one side, then the other, and they'd keep arguing back and forth. The state should reduce it. The judge is protected that if the state's attorney doesn't go along with it, well, there can't be an agreement. But a lot of times the state's attorney will want to know what the judge thinks. And at first I thought, you know, that's wrong, that's not what this is all about. Finally, a defense attorney looked up at me one day and said, "Judge, will you kindly put us out of our misery?" I mean, he knew he was getting nowhere, but he couldn't cave in until I had said no. I mean, they're used to a judge saying, "Well, if that's the evidence, I'm going to rule so, thus and so." You know, I always thought that was bad form, because you never know what the,
Were there any particular challenges just in running a courtroom? You talked about the sort of administrative role, but with all those people and observance?
Well, I always, you know, one of the things which doesn't directly answer your question but has a great deal to do with the administration of a trial, is how my courtroom clerk kept me awake. If she saw that I was flagging, she always kept a law book on the rail beside her, and she would knock it onto the floor and fall all over herself apologizing to me for interrupting. She was the most wonderful clerk you could imagine. The other way I knew if I was flagging, I always took notes. The first few trials I thought, oh no, this is so vivid, I'll never forget that. And by the third trial I was mixing up the facts of one trial and another, so I always took notes after that. And when I looked down and my handwriting was illegible, I didn't know what I was writing, I decided to call. The judge always has the advantage of calling a recess. Attorneys can say, Your Honor, I have to go to the bathroom, but that's not the only thing to hold. But then just administering the timing of it, you know, if you get late in the afternoon, how much do you ask them how long the next witness is going to take? And would you rather stick it out, or do you want to break in? So, a lot of things, you know, are educational, but don't really have much impact on how the system runs. You discover some amazing things, like gun control, for example. That's not an issue in a case, but you know, I had a case where a man shot his wife in the head and rendered her a vegetable, and so we had a trial on it, and what had happened was they'd taken a vacation and gone down to Atlanta, and they thought, you know, we can't buy guns in Chicago, but anybody can buy a gun in Atlanta, why don't we just buy ourselves a gun to protect against burglars? And so they each took them back to Chicago with them, and the night before this night, they'd gotten in an intense argument, and the wife had shot at the husband but missed. Well, that had sort of jolted them out of their argument at that point. And the next night, same thing happened, only this time it was the husband who shot and he didn't miss. And when the police, you know, the neighbors called the police. When the police came, the husband was sitting in the middle of the line room, sitting in the middle of the living room floor, sobbing because, you know, what he'd done to his wife. And so, you know, they tried to see if there were any ways they could get it reduced from first degree murder, but it was a bench trial. And then it came to the sentencing, and you know, I gave some thought to this and said, you know, there's nothing the court can do that's going to punish you anywhere near what you've already punished yourself. I mean, that's going to live with you the rest of your life, so that's off to one side. That meanwhile, the justice system has to do what it has to do, and so I sentenced him to 12 years and would explain that, you know, I assumed that was the lesser of the penalties he was getting. And but, you know, it points up, you know, don't have guns lying around. I had one capital case on my call at the time I left the bench. I never had a capital case up to that point. I was just as happy to leave. I decided that if I had it, if it had gone to trial and I'd been found guilty, all the procedure for a problem followed, I would have sentenced him to death, because that would be my obligation. But I wasn't very comfortable about it. Delighted when that kind of case didn't get very far.
Did you feel any extra burden having to deliberate on all these bench trials as opposed to
what I did was, and I, this was, you know, you learn by doing. I made some mistakes early on. I would always, even on a ruling on a bench trial, in the first place, I would never rule on the same day. I would always want to go back and review my quotes and put a little distance between me and them. And then I would write out my ruling. And if I couldn't make sense of it in writing it out, well, I knew there was something the matter. I would see that this particular point was crucial in the chain of logic to get to this conclusion. And I'd look and I'd say, I remember that this was evidence. And then I'd look back and it wasn't. Why did I have to, you know, you're prey to all sorts of imaginings if you don't. It's unusual, I think, for most judges. I guess the more experienced ones don't feel they need to. They've been at it long enough. They don't feel comfortable about doing it, but I never did. I was, you know, even after 6 years, but after that third trial, I quickly changed. And one group of people I always made friends with by doing this was, I would, when I would read my ruling, then the court reporter would turn to me and say, Judge, can I borrow your book now? So that they would get it. I mean, as long as, I mean, they were taking it all down, but, you know, transcription is always imperfect at best. And so they always, things they couldn't quite hear or didn't quite get right, they wanted to check it against what I'd actually written. Then another thing that I did when, during closing arguments, I would take notes, but then I would make margin notes as I went along about the conduct of the attorneys, you know, quality of their performance. And the state's attorneys would just lie in wait for me after any trials and then, would you go over your notes with us? Because they were eager to learn. But, no, the one that I probably should have recused myself on, but it was much too far along at that point. I didn't feel that anything would be gained by starting over again, particularly with another judge. During a break, there were some young people in the back of the room, and you know, when we came out to restart the trial again. I was chatting with these guys, and we're the only ones in the courtroom. Everybody else was out in the corridor, and I'd sent the bailiff out to get them. So I was, you know, wondering how they were, what they were learning from this proceeding, and why were they here, and, you know, they said, oh, they weren't friends of the defendant, and I said, oh, that's nice, I'm glad he's, you know, has your support, and, you know, it makes him feel good. And then they said, you have a daughter at Kenwood High School? I said, yes, my daughter Barbara. Well, we're classmates of hers. And I said, well, I'll tell her I ran into you. But, you know, that's a little too close for comfort. The only time that they really got out of, the attorneys got out of control, and I used to take my gavel there, but what I found was that if I, sometimes I would scowl and that would tone them down, and if they really started getting bad, I would do a little tap like that, and that would stop them in their tracks. I mean, I don't know, there's something about me that must be terrifying. I never figured out what it is. But one time, the attorneys were hurling personal insults at each other, and one guy slammed down his folder of papers on the table, but they came at an angle, so they scooted all across the room, and I was trying to regain control, and I banged my pen down, and it got out of my hand and went up and hit the ceiling. And the jury said later, that was really the high point of the trial. That was as far as I ever got in the church. No, I had, excusing jurors was a poignant sort of thing. I'd observed that the more serious the charges were, the more likely I would get an affirmative answer to the question, have you ever been the victim of a crime? And I don't know whether that was because people wanted to serve or what, but a lot of people just didn't want to serve on a murder trial, and you would get some horrifying stories. And, you know, finally I would say to them, would you rather not sit on this case? And I'm not even asking the attorneys. And, you know, they said they thought they could be fair. Well, I said, oh, that's... And then if the attorneys wanted to bump them, that would be fine, too. I had one lady... It's amazing, the charge seemed to trigger memories. And this was a rape case, and I had one lady, and I said, have you ever been the victim of a crime? And she said somewhat nervously, yes. And I said, well, what was the nature of the crime, and how long, when was it? And she said, well, it was 25 years ago, and it was rape. And I said, oh, I said, well, is there anything in that experience that still stays with you that would keep you from being a fair juror here? And instead of answering, she just started to go to pieces. And I finally said to her, would you rather not serve? And she nodded, and I said, well, the lady deputy will take you out and sit with you for a while. At the end of the afternoon, after we picked the jury and everybody had gone home, the lady deputy came and said, what will we do with this person? I said, she's still there? I said, yes. Turns out she had never told anybody in the 25 years that she'd been raped. And she thought since the judge asked her, she had to tell. And it was just, you know, put you in a sort of a godlike position that you'd rather not be in. So you have to be careful how you throw your power around, because some people are going to take you very, very seriously. Amusing ones that give you a little laughter break. We had a police decoy case, police decoy theft case. Do you know what that would be? A policewoman in what is called street clothes went to the Taste of Chicago out on Navy Pier, and she had had a purse slung over her shoulder, and sticking out of it very visibly was a $20 bill. Four paces behind her was a plainclothes policeman, so the first poor mope that grabbed it was nabbed. You know, this is as close as you can get to entrapment without actually throwing the case out. Well, the first surprise was the defendant didn't want to plead. Second surprise was that he wanted a jury trial. I said, okay, you... And the public defender was beside himself. He said, Judge, this is what my client wants. I said, well, you're doing your job. You'll have a jury trial. So we picked a jury trial. The evidence ran for 20 minutes or so. And I instructed the jury on the law, and they retired. That was about 2:30 or 3 in the afternoon. And then I did some paperwork or something, just waiting for them to come back so we could all go home. And at 6 o'clock, the bailiff came in and said, you're going to have to send out for supper, feed the jurors. I said, you're kidding. No, they can't reach a verdict. And then we went until about 9 o'clock, and the bailiff came in and said, you're going to have to sequester the jury. I'll call ahead to the motel and tell them we're coming. Okay. I have no idea what was going on. And so the next morning they brought him back in. I charged them to go back into the jury room and begin their deliberations again. Then I started my morning call. Halfway through the call, there was a terrible uproar in the corridor behind my courtroom. I said to the deputy, go find out what's happening. So she came back in and interrupted the proceedings and said, Judge, I think you better come. The holdout juror had run screaming from the jury room and gone into the chambers of the adjoining judge and locked herself in the bathroom for her own protection. Well, who was this holdout juror? Well, in picking the jury, people probably couldn't care less who the jurors were in this case, but one of them was a secretary who worked for the Chicago Police Department. I thought, surely the defense is going to bump her, and they said, no, she looks like an honest woman. I think probably they said, what the hell difference does it make, let her sit. Turns out she was the holdout. She said she never believed a policeman in her life, and she wasn't going to start now. she was a secretary for the Chicago Police Department. So I hung the jury. And then after that, the public defender came and said he's ready to plead now. He had his phone. The public defender said, you cannot count on this ever happening again. Anything else you need to know?
If you were talking to a newly appointed judge, would you have any advice or guidance as they started their tenure on the bench?
I think humility goes a long way, not assuming you know things. There's a temptation to think that you have to fulfill your role of being all-knowing. When you're not supposed to be all-wise, all-knowing, you're supposed to be all-fair. That's quite a difference, because you can be terribly unfair to somebody by pretending to know things you don't know. And listening is a great talent. The other thing is that I've noticed often is lacking in courtrooms is respect for everybody. I used to wonder how I would handle defendants who acted out. I never found out how I would react because it never happened. And the reason it never happened is I always treated the defendant just like everybody else in the courtroom as human beings. And they were the defendant, that's all they were. They were not criminals, they were not lowlife, they were people. And if you accord people respect, you never call a defendant by his first name. It's always Mr. And never make cutting remarks about them. That's, the attorneys can do what they want within limits, but you only tolerate so much. And you don't even have to enforce that because you, the thing about a courtroom is that people have very, very good antenna. They can walk into a courtroom and sense what sort of a courtroom it is and what goes and what doesn't go. And you don't really have to. I thought I would have to instruct my staff. Well, you don't have to instruct your staff. They're with you 2 days, and they pick it all up. And, so in terms of court management, I think that's the thing that came as one of the big surprises to me. That I didn't realize what was happening at first until I had a friend who brought his college class down to sit through a morning's proceeding. It didn't happen to be a trial, but just a regular call. Then we went into chambers and answered their questions. And one of the kids asked about keeping order in the courtroom, and the male deputy spoke up. I was startled by this. He said, "You know, everybody takes their cue from the judge. And you don't have any problems in this courtroom." And, you know, I didn't realize that was what was going on. I was wondering when it was going to happen. I thought maybe they were giving me a honeymoon or something before they started really getting to me, but they never did. So it was a very meaningful experience for me all the way around. I once stopped at the McDonald's on Chicago Avenue that's now being rebuilt. Used to have a Burger King and a McDonald's side by side, and I'd been doing a little shopping over the lunch hour and didn't know if I'd have time for a bite, so I thought I'd just duck into McDonald's and grab a hamburger and maybe bring it back with me if I even eat it on the bus, which is probably a felony or something. And there was a guy outside passing out little leaflets that said, two Big Macs for the price of one. Well, I didn't want even one Big Mac, let alone two, but I'm polite, so I took it, put it in my pocket, and walked in. I was distressed to see there were about six people in every line. So I stood there, and almost immediately somebody bumped into me from the back, so I turned around and looked up at him. I'm 6 feet tall, so this was a big, mean-looking black guy. So I said, "Oh, I'm sorry." And I turned around and waited a little bit longer, and it happened again. He bumped into me. It was pretty clear that it was not accidental, so I thought, well, he's going to be asking for a handout. So I turned around and looked at him straight in the face, waited for him to speak. And he said what would probably be the most frightening words you can imagine. He said, "Judge Theodore M. Swain." I said, "Oh my God, he even remembered my middle initial." So I just lit up like that. I said, "Oh, you were in my courtroom." And he said, "Yeah." And I said, what was the charge? And he said, "Felony amount of possession of drugs." And I said, "And what was the sentence?" And he said, 2.5 years. I said, "Well, how was the experience?" he said, it wasn't bad. He was out now. I said, while this was happening, while this all was going on, a busboy had seen what was brewing and had turned tail and run. And I thought, what a coward he is. But what he was doing was running for the manager. And so the manager came up at about that point and was about to hustle a guy off. And I said, no, I know the gentleman. And the manager's face just fell. He went ahead shaking his head, went away shaking his head. And I turned to the guy and said, "Would you like a Big Mac?" Since McDonald's was paying for it, I thought I could afford to be generous. He said, "Yes." So we sat down and had our Big Macs together. Somewhere in the middle of it, he sort of got confused, and I think he began to think of me not as the judge, but as God somehow. I mean, you know, he talked that way. But I wished him well and went out my way. But that's only the most dramatic. I've encountered three or four of my people I've sentenced, and nobody seems to hold a grudge. They want a fair trial is what they want, and they're told they'll never get one. And if they get one, it's... The other thing I was surprised at was one of the public defenders came up to me and said, the state's attorney came up to me and said, in a case where I had acquitted the defendant, and on a bench trial, and he said, "Judge, I just want to thank you for for letting the prosecuting witness tell her story. I looked at him, said a lot of judges wouldn't have, you know, would have brushed it aside. I mean, made short work of it. I said, you've got to be kidding. They're, no, no, that's what happens. They get impatient. They know it's all made up or something. You know, people want to be heard. And you just don't know what you're doing right, or you don't know what you're doing wrong until that happens too. But I had a lucky tenure. And I developed a good deal of respect for the journeyman judges that fill our courts. You know, they're not Harvard graduates, and they're they've come from all strata of society, but they're all trying to do a job. I differ with them on some of the techniques of how to run a courtroom. But they're all, and, you know, but for them, the system would be a mess. You know, they do it. 98% of the cases, they just, it's routine, and they handle it beautifully and get the job done. It's hard to think of that as a job. There are judges who think of it as an elevated status rather than a job. It's interesting work, though. Anything else?
I think that's about it.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for sharing all this time and your recollections with us.
Trip down memory lane.